Welcome to the Performance Health Podcast. My name is Tim Caron. Today we're on season 5, episode 5, talking about exercise selection. We've been building for this for a while, so this is an important episode based off of what we just talked about with frequency and training split or program design for a microcycle. It's going to be a monster episode. We want to break down how we're going to select exercises, why that's important, and then the eventual intersection with the variables we choose for those said exercises. If you like what you're hearing, head over to phpodcast.com. We got a collection of memberships you can subscribe to, get you private access to a bunch of original content like program reviews, lectures, and web shows, as well as a new membership platform we're developing called The Collective. It's going to be a special group of coaches that get you access to weekly calls, book of the month club, and then much, much more. Let's talk about exercise selection.
Tim, we're back talking exercise selection today. A little late in the game, so I'm sure many people are wondering, why did we wait so long to get into exercise selection?
Sure. No, I'm kidding. So I would come back and say that there's so much preliminary information we need to gather. And there's so much stuff that we need to know and understand, and so much stuff that we need to understand what we have control over and what we don't have control of. That's central as to why we choose to put exercise selection as the fifth podcast in this programming series, just to acknowledge the fact that if we don't know what the underlying problems are, what the goals are, what are our frequency, and then what are the training splits we're allowed to work with, and then the exercises we choose don't really matter, right? And that part, I think it's, in terms of order operations or the just pure complexity that we can do our programming with, right? And we have to eventually get down to the other end of this, of when we select our exercises, sets, reps, intensity, rest, time or attention, this intersection of variables in exercise selection, that there's going to be bottlenecks. And we look at the ability, we look at the knowledge, we look at the facility, the staff, and how we can integrate with all that. You know, the exercise selection to me feels not trivial and not unimportant, but definitely in terms of all hosts of things that we need to consider prior to, and then not only that, after, makes it warranted to be put as a fifth episode in this series. But doesn't make it unimportant overall. It just means that we have to work through a lot of detail and just information to make sure that we're making the best decision possible.
All right. So then we did all this preliminary test and we got all this data. What's the decision tree as we go through exercise selection?
Well, I mean, we got to face facts that eventually we're going to load these patterns redundantly, meaning we're going to do them multiple times per week, multiple times throughout the course of a mesocycle and a macrocycle. And then we're going to do it to threshold, that we're going to push it to some sort of voluntary maximal effort, that they're going to have to express the qualities or the biomotor abilities to their utmost level. And when we think about the exercises that we're going to do redundantly and we're going to push a threshold, we have to ask ourselves, are there exercises that might be potentially limited if we were going to push to threshold redundantly? And that creates a central theme to our exercise selection. Now, we can't just simply just choose exercise without any kind of awareness that eventually this could be problematic or hit diminishing returns. That becomes a central theme, is what we need to investigate with our information gathering. And I start to look at the biomechanical assessment, the physiological assessment, all the preliminary information to make sure that I'm choosing the exercise that I can push to threshold redundantly. And if I don't have an inventory of that, and I'm kind of shooting blind in the dark, and I don't necessarily have a really good idea that an exercise will react a certain way when I do it multiple times a week, a month, a year, and done to some sort of physical voluntary limit. And that's a problem. And that's a big problem, because when we think about this, it's sometimes conveyed in the option that we can get away with. We have a lot of latitudes when we're working one-on-one. Like if I was going to personal train you, Corey, and you were going to come to me and you're like, I don't really want to go through all this screening process and these tests to determine what exercise is quote unquote best or worst. I just want to train. I can pivot relatively quickly based off of seeing something that's not working right. And sometimes that gives us a little bit of a gravitas going into our group training program and think it's the same. It's a one-to-one exchange. It's not. We have certain levels that are going to be manifested out towards a larger group if we don't have this baseline preliminary information that is going to compound negatively, meaning that we're going to have multiple people doing things incorrectly or doing things that are potentially contraindicated. And those multiple people have a negative impact on those around them. And then the standard becomes somewhat lower. The ceiling drops And all of a sudden we have a program that doesn't produce as much results as we'd like, as well as potentially puts people in harm's way. And having an inventory of, am I working with you one-on-one? And am I going to have a lot of latitude in that actually boots in the ground executing on the plan that I can see very quickly, this is going to be square peg round hole and I can pivot? Or am I going to be in a group dynamic where if I don't really focus on what's the best exercise? And there's another way to do that. It's programming to the lowest common denominator. Like, who's going to be the worst in the room and programming around that. And there's no right or wrong here, but I would say if we're trying to optimize that experience and try to get the best performance with the least risk possible, having that information on the front end to choose exercises, that's got to be at least in the conversation. If not, could you skip the first four steps and just go right into just throwing exercises on a sheet and with certain arbitrary sets, reps, intensity, time, and attention, and just going to work?
So, I mean, it's pretty obvious here. We're not saying like you have to squat, you have to do, or you have to back squat. Like, we're going to focus on patterns. How do you make sure you're getting enough of like in different vectors with different implements, all that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, create rules. That's one of the big things I talk about a lot, is having some sort of list or rule to hold you accountable or hold you to a standard. And a very simple one is whatever you push, you pull. So that creates this dichotomy of movement that you start to break down of, okay, well, if I'm pressing something, I'm about to eventually pull it. And that could go into, I'm doing chest and back. I can go into quads and hamstrings. Like, that's, if you have no experience with traditional pattern-based training of a squat, hinge, push, and pull, then you start to think about it, well, how would I explain this to a layman? How would I explain this to a two-year-old? How would I explain this to someone just getting started? It's like, well, we're going to work chest, back, quads, and hamstrings. And what that does is gets these big global movers, quad, hamstrings, pecs, and lats, to get stronger and start to develop a cascade effect into these more distal muscle groups like forearms, calves, and maybe we get a better overall systemic effect. And then we could get this other element of those movement patterns could be further broken down into a vertical horizontal of the upper body. So whatever I push or pull can be done in this up and down or forward and back, depending on my orientation of my body. So if I'm on my back, I'm still pressing horizontally. It just happened to be go up and down because that's where the resistance curve is to gravity. And then I look at it from a lower body. You know, traditionally that's broken up a little bit differently. In posterior chain, you have hip and knee dominant. So if I'm doing hip bridge or some sort of knee dominant leg curl. And if I'm looking at a squat pattern, it's less hip dominant, which you could argue of like, hey, hip flexion is the same thing as knee flexion in some regards. So if we're working more of the proximal or the distal tissues of the quads or hamstrings, but traditionally when we're looking at a lower body push, that's broken up into a bilateral or unilateral. And then we could further break that down between all upper and lower. So we look at all this stuff can be done bilaterally or unilaterally. Just happens to be the way we kind of like, I guess, focus our distribution of patterns or are allocating a stress towards muscle groups is broken up into this upper body horizontal push and pull, or horizontal and vertical pushing pull. And then we look at lower body hip dominant, knee dominant, posterior chain, or this anterior chain of effect over a knee dominant or a knee dominant lower body bilateral unilateral push. And as we break down this and we start to think about those rules and how we're starting to hold ourselves accountable, you know, we simply just say like, all right, if I push it, I got to pull it. Like, that's a pretty simple way to break it down. But then we start to look at it from maybe we need to have a multi-vector, multi-planar approach, right? So there's three cardinal planes, sagittal, transverse, and frontal. There's three primary vectors, vertical, horizontal, rotational. They kind of overlap a lot. What you traditionally see though is a lot of this based off of resistance to gravity. So if a barbell is being used, then it's going to be resisted greatest when it's perpendicular to gravity. If we're using a dumbbell, same thing. Anything that we drop, it'll fall to the ground. We'll probably have some sort of resistance based off of where it is perpendicular to gravity. So we look at it from most of our lower body, upper body pushes and pulls are going to be this horizontal or vertical orientation to try to have resistance based off of gravity, which gives some sort of inclination. If we want to really work horizontal, we want to really work transverse or rotational, they would probably have to at least include something in terms of a cable column, some pneumatic resistance, or even flywheel or conical based resistance. But all that being said is now we can start to create more criteria. So if I push and pull it, whatever I do in the sagittal, I got to think about having some sort of variation in the frontal or the transverse or whatever I do in the vertical, I got to think about some sort of orientation of the horizontal and the that. And just to completely frank, without getting like very physics-y or engineering, if you're going to do some sort of vertical overhead press, you should do some sort of flat press. Like that is the way you look at orientation of vectors. I mean, instead of changing the resistance, we're changing the body's angle, relatively speaking, to it. If I'm going to do some sort of split squat, I should think about doing a lateral squat or a rotational posterior lateral squat of some nature. There's forces that are going to directly be aligned. So if I'm doing an RDL, then the forces are going to be more vertical. But if I'm going to do a single leg RDL with a contralateral resistance, meaning I'm holding a dumbbell opposite of my stance leg, there's some sort of anti-rotational effect or counter to that rotational vector, which is loading that vector eccentrically into that plane. There's a lot of that. But then there's another rule of, okay, well, if I was going to do this to threshold redundantly, what would be the problem? And if I can figure out a way to remove the bottleneck, whether there's going to be a lowered ceiling or potentially a higher risk of injury, should I at least inventory that? And that's why I make rules like, if I find asymmetry on my either force plate analysis or my movement assessment, I'm going to default to doing unilateral push and pull. And just, that's it, right? And I always get the, well, you know, what if? Like, yeah, but I'm playing law of averages here because I work with large groups. I got 600 clients coming to my gym every single day. I need to play a larger game here in terms of if we were to distill out that singular anecdote of one person not getting hurt and then the other person getting hurt, and that fractals out to now 300 of my 600 getting hurt, I have to play to the side of the person potentially getting hurt. And that applies to team setting, that applies to working in the high school setting, the college, the pro, that we have to create these rules that are logical, intuitive, and agreed upon to select the best exercises overall. And then getting away or detaching from, well, if it's not going well, I can just pivot quickly. You probably can't to the degree that you want when you have multiple coaches and multiple athletes working at a given time, relatively speaking to you working one-on-one, and you can pivot to something a lot better or a lot more specific and aligned with what we're trying to accomplish on that given day, relatively speaking to a goal. So thinking about that, of rules need to govern groups, rules need to govern decision-making. There's two things to manage. There's group size and then length, right? So there's a time variant and a quantity variant that we need to evaluate when we're selecting rules. And if I was going to look at this over time, would that mistake be enough to be inhibitive to the results I want to get? We should create rules to limit that inhibition. Then we should look at it from a quantity perspective. It was going to take that singular number and then aggregate that out to multiple people. Would it create some sort of inhibitive effect? So you can look at this as almost this like line that we have going up and down as the X to the Y axis, and then the time over the X axis or vice versa. And then we think about that in terms of, this is going to be the intersection of trying to do as much threshold without risk as possible and choosing rules to stay within that sweet spot. And that part becomes very interesting to me. And having these, like, what is true on a micro versus a macro scale becomes more and more important from that time versus quantity variables, and having really a good dialed in system to be successful over time. Because you shouldn't be surprised at the end of a training phase that, oh wow, this didn't really get what we wanted, or man, that was grossly what I did not expect. And that part to me has become more of a, I guess, afterthought, that the outcome is, I think, unnecessarily expected, which I think we should still do our due diligence and focus on what is this from a systemic level, the problem I'm trying to work on versus the deals that the problems I'm inheriting and trying to find solutions to fix. And from an exercise selection standpoint, how we're taking this baseline information, it's seeing patterns and creating rules to solve that systemically over a longer period of time.
So you covered a lot in terms of how to make sure, you know, everything's balanced, pushing, pulling in every vector. How do you go about distributing that in, you know, the various time slots that you've been given, whether it's 2, 3, 4, et cetera?
Yeah. So we talked about this last week in terms of our training split, and we get into this, what is going to be your keystone piece? So typically it's that denoted as your primary exercise on that given day. And those primaries kind of set the training split. And we look at it from a 3-day total body or 4-day upper or lower, you know, the primary two ones. We talked about a little bit about the 5-day body part split, But as a whole, whatever that first exercise is on that given day is the foundational piece for the exercise selection in that given workout. And a lot of that stems from the idea that a lot of these big movements, whether it's a 4-day total body, which breaks up really conveniently into that push, pull, hinge, and squat, sets the foundation off of that rotation. And then you look at it primarily that A1 or that primary exercise gets a little bit more volume, a little bit more intensity, because we're in this fresher CNS or muscular system state that we can tolerate more. But we typically see that becomes more of a point of emphasis, that this is our big ROI period. If we look at it from a Pareto principle, that we're going to get 80% of the results from 20% of the things we do. So if we have 100 exercises, then really only 20% of them are really going to make a difference. But with that being said, is we look at those big four, we look at that same ratio. If I'm going to do those four exercises, that the other 12 exercises in that given training week are going to be maybe not as impactful to the bottom line. I think there's a danger in that logic, that we typically see structural imbalance. We see some sort of myopic focus on certain exercises and certain things that are just based off of bias or opinion and maybe even agenda. But we can also get into eventually we got to start settling on doing something. And we look at it from the end of, well, this person's faster or stronger, or my kind of three big things of, can they run faster? Can they jump higher? Or can they project a med bile further? And then reverse engineering the process of that and saying, okay, well, where does a squat fit in? Where does a hinge fit in? Where does an upper body or upper body push or pull fit in? And then start to build the workout around it. And off of that, we start seeing complementary things from a CNS loading perspective. So certain things just have a lower ceiling from a CNS loading. So if I was going to do a back squat paired up with a deadlift, those would be two high systemic loads, which every once in a while, there might be a reason or rationale to do that. But there might be a case to be made about doing a alternating sequence of high threshold or high CNS impactful type movements with a high ceiling of external load paired up with something of a lower load. There might be an element of hitting different planes and vectors for something that's extremely sagittal plane dominant in complement to that. There might be a case to be made about, all right, I'm going to organize this to really get the most from the next training session. So if I look at it from, let's say that I was going to do a 3-day total body lift and my B and C series have a ton of muscular damage that leads into that next day and inhibiting performance on that primary, that we're supposed to squeeze out as much from that exercise or that movement pattern as possible. There's an element of that. Then there's also an element of potentially focus and fatigue intersecting in those latter half. And do we need to pick exercises with cook or fail safe? Stuff that we actually physically have to hold, like a dumbbell or med ball versus a barbell, where we kind of get away with just managing that load somewhere in my back or my shoulder and grinding through reps and the residual or the negative consequence of that. And all that being said is that we have some sort of split that we work off, a 3-day total body or 4-day upper lower. Talked a little bit about a push pull. We may even talked about a 5-day program, looking at body part splits. We built some sort of foundation of that workout of, here's the target of that workout based off of the qualities I'm trying to develop, whether it's power, functional or relative strength, functional hypertrophy or muscular endurance. And then I start to build in what exercises in that movement pattern would facilitate that quality. Then I start to say that exercise is going to be there. That's going to be the biggest distribution of time, effort, and energy throughout that course of the workout. And I start to build the exercises to complement that based off the other day. So I have structural balance and also have really good quality from start to finish of that workout, hopefully facilitating a very predictable and high level of outcome with minimal risk.
So I wanted to go back to that idea of like the 80-20 rule and focusing on our primaries. Would you say that with that rule in mind, your primaries rotate, you rotate your primaries a little less frequently and you rotate your other things a little more? How do you rotate through your exercises in terms of, we're getting what we want, should we stick with it until we don't, or when should we make that cutoff?
There's soft rules in terms of novices need longer time with certain exercises than advanced, because advanced need less time to get to maximal threshold load. Mm-hmm. So there's that. There's certain things in terms of this person's really fast twitch, they're just going to burn out quick if we don't have a high exercise rotation. Just to be completely frank, some of the very high variation based methods are based off of pharmaceutical enhanced programs. Like, they just are. Like, if you think about West Side or powerlifting, that has a high degree of rotation of exercises, just they're just incredibly adept at responding to it based off of being on anabolic steroids. And that leads into their soft tissue, connective tissue is going to be at a compromised state because of all the stress we're putting on the muscular tissue, developing those big patterns. So having a high degree of variation matters quite a bit. But then there's another element of, you know, we want to go until we can't get any more from that exercise. And it's having an arbitrary, hey, 2 weeks for advanced and 8 weeks for novice, or we're working incredibly high level of muscular endurance. So we typically see a burnout effect from 2 weeks of that, you know, or fast twitch muscle fiber athletes respond quicker. So they need shorter mesos, and we look at slow twitch athletes need longer mesos. It could just be like, I can keep loading this. Like I still have room. I still have a little bit of water left in the towel. And that's the metaphor we give our clients all the time, is the towel is filled with water every week. You're wringing it out a little bit more. And by the end of the week, you want to squeeze it as hard as possible. That thing is almost dry as sandpaper. And when we get to that end of, if you squeeze it as hard as you can on that last week, knowing that you gave your best effort from a technical standpoint, as well as from an effort standpoint in the previous three, then we've optimized and maximized that training block. If we wring the towel out week one and we got nothing left, you know, case could be made that progressive overload is now out the window, and we are not going to see any adaptive responses to that because we just simply just went too hard, and we're not going to have any potential to look at the cause and effect relationship of doing an exercise with a certain set of variables and see what the impact residually over time is. But there is an element of, hey, in a certain setting, in a certain world, you might just have to land the plane and decide on, we're going to do a 4 week meso no matter what, or we're going to do 2 week accumulation block and we're going to do 4 week intensification blocks. Might be we're going to do a mixed method and we're going to hit some sort of quality on every given workout, whether it's power, relative strength, functional hypertrophy, or muscular endurance every single session. We might do a concurrent, we might do focus on a single day of that, but it gets down to how long can I progressively overload safely and effectively? And there could be an argument to be made about a 12 week very Kaizen method, like in small incremental load over time and trying to get as much biomotor, biomechanic, bioenergetic development with very simple, intuitive, logical things that the athletes walk in and go, I know what I need to do. I just need to do it at a high level. Just strip away the nuance and just say work and work really hard. And that's been proven time and time again to be wildly effective versus a very, very, very nuanced approach of, I just found out Corey's very fast switch and he has a high training age and he does really well with intensification blocks. So I'm going to pick the sweet spot of 3 weeks or getting three microcycles. And if we look at a microcycle as the completion of one workout to repeating that workout again, a mesocycle is looking at it going through one microcycle to completion of that said microcycle. So we now go to a new microcycle format, and that could either through exercises or variables. And all that being said, is it really gets down to this quality that we're trying to develop from that microcycle has to matter, relatively speaking, to the greater goal. And if that doesn't have any development from 1 week to the next, or we don't squeeze out as much from those actual exercises, sets, reps, intensity, time under tension as we possibly can, then we're really not viewing this in the right way. The exercises are conduits. The variables we put onto that are amplifiers of that exercise. If that conduit amplification doesn't really get what we want, we're misguided with the thought process of our training, that each step along the way is a fractal relationship to an outcome based off of underlying problems that we did. And that's why it's so important that we get this baseline information. And if we're just not gathering information and we're not understanding the assignment, we're going to miss out on probably the most important factor of training. It's problem solving and getting to an outcome repeatedly and consistently, because that's what we're paid to do. That if I bring my car to the auto body shop and they say, I don't know what's wrong with it, I'm just going to do random stuff on it, it's not better, I'm going to feel ripped off. And the same thing with training. If I'm not taking any inventory of what's wrong and I'm not fixing anything that was a problem, that in effect is a huge issue with not really understanding your job. And yes, I might have an opinion. I might have an agenda. I might have things that I like to do. Show me your weight room. I'll show you your philosophy. I have bars, racks, dumbbells, kettlebells. Like, very obvious what I'm eventually going to do. It's just a matter of how I organize that and how I layer that so I can get you to the best outcome. But I do know my bottlenecks. I do know my shortcomings. I do know the limitations of that style of programming, and I have to compensate for that in some way to get to an outcome more consistently and as expedited a level as possible without collateral damage.
Yeah, that was well said, Tim. I really like the towel water analogy. I think I'm going to steal that one with my students. They're always like, you know, they just can't, it's on me, obviously. I can't relay the message. That's good. That's really well said. I'm going to have to steal that one. This has been great. Thank you. Big thing, create rules.
That's it, man.
Keep it simple.
Yeah. If you don't have rules, you're probably going to be vulnerable to making bad decisions. And If you're wondering why you have a job or don't have a job, if you're wondering why someone has something more than you, it's just probably discipline with decision-making and being governed by rules. And I mean, if you think about it from a theology perspective, like all the Ten Commandments are just rules of conduct to not make other people's lives worse and have the most purposeful and meaningful life. And I don't think you can say that there's 10 commandments to training, but there's definitely if we do this and we have some sort of accountability and standards and some sort of constraints on our decision-making, we're probably going to be able to get to an outcome more consistently and in a more rapid manner than if we didn't. So having that in place and just going through that. And those are one thing I would like to say on rules. Rules are context dependent.
Yeah.
They're not universal. So the rules for me in my weight room, they don't have to apply. And quite frankly, if you're not going through the inventory of what you need, you probably just need to reevaluate that. And they should have some sort of connection to your overall philosophy. And it should have some sort of interaction with the problems or the bottlenecks that you're facing every single day as a coach. And if they do, you can refine and improve your rules. If they don't, those rules are just things on a wall that people just kind of look at and say, I guess that's something we should be striving to do. I just don't know how that connects to what we're doing here.
Yeah. All right. That's the mic drop moment.
Hell yeah.
See you, Tim.